Very interesting material we're working through here. I'm learning a lot. I've had the general framework about what happened in the Middle East and around the land and so forth, but you ask another question beyond the surface, and right away you're out of information. So it's been exciting to read. One of the books I've not said much about books, but one of the books I really have enjoyed and resourced a lot is a book called 1919 Paris by Margaret McMillan. And I see she's quoted quite a bit in a source for World War II, particularly Versailles. So it's only about that big, but it's worth doing. And there's stuff in there that I haven't even touched on yet. So we've been focusing our attention on the aspect on the Ottoman Empire breakup and the assignment of the lands that were formerly under the Ottoman Empire. And there are so many details to all of this that it's, you know, just can't pack it into one lesson. And so we are taken somewhat by subjects. But today, we do want to work through more consciously the conferences that occurred, although they're not going to loom large in the lesson. You have to always see the details. The excitement is in the details, but I think you'll get a sense that these conferences that occur after Versailles, starting with Versailles, and ends up down here on July 23rd, which is the League of Nations finally ratify everything that's ever been done. And so that period of time is we're in, and there are questions that come up in this period that we need to deal with, and I had a whole section to do, but they're not going to get that done today, so we'll do that next week. And now we'll deal with some of the objections, you know, that we hear all the time on radio about why this is so unfair and why this has been such a disgrace to the people, the indigenous peoples in the land, and you hear all these things. So we'll deal with some of those questions, and they're really not hard to answer because, as you know from 4 weeks ago, once you establish what international law says about the land, the rest of it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter, although it does matter because they become political ideas that are kicked around, and to that extent we sort of feel compelled a little bit to have to answer them. You know, it's kind of like evolution. You say, well, if you can't, the guy that argues evolution says, well, you can't argue from ultimate beginnings. Why do we even have this discussion? You know, like Big Bang. Well, what happened before the Big Bang? Well, he's got nothing to say, so there's really no discussion. So we have to humor him and discuss it anyway. So there's a little bit of that with the international law. Once the international law has been said and in place, what else can you say about what's right and what's wrong? Might discuss about what happened after that and the miscarriage of justice regarding international law, and we'll do that. So we're going to end it at we're going to end the Versailles and move a little bit further on, but it just basically moves along our timeline. As I mentioned, we spent a number of weeks already in the post-World War I period, that lessons 32 to 36, this is 36, and there's about four years, not quite 4 years, between the armistice and when this is finally all settled. I think I have 22 up there. That's right, 1922. I'm going to start to say 2022 because now I'm into the 20s. I can't get out of my head which millennium we're in. So by that time, you know, it's settled. That just means that's when the different kind of trouble began, and which will be part of our lessons as we move forward, moving early to our time. Now, just a note here, there is one other treaty to note, that after the division of the Ottoman Empire, the Turks did not accept the borders as set by the Versailles Conference. So they went to war. The only country that I know of after World War I returned to war for what they thought were our improper borders. And remember, they're the ones that were dismantled. And if you look at a map, I didn't bring a map, when the Versailles people were done with dismantling Turkey, it looked like a Holstein cow. You know, so it had no rhyme or reason for what it was done, but everybody wanted a hunk, you know, like the wolves, you know, take a hunk out of the calf here and another one here. And so we have this really odd-looking piece. Well, it was really unworkable from any standpoint. So they did go to war, and that war lasted in about 4 years. And they did force another treaty out of it, and that's the treaty we're going to I mentioned here. And it's a treaty that favored the Turks and left within Turkey a large contingent of Christians, quote, they're called Arminians, not the theological ones, but these are the people group Arminians, and they basically massacred them because they were Christians, Turks were Muslims. And I say that now because, remember, later on we'll use what happens to people that are in the land. You know, no one's ever done anything about this. It still is something they have not acknowledged, and there's been books written about it if you're interested in that. So we're not quite going to discuss that. That's just a little tangent on the side. So we want to address the times of the peace conference at Versailles. Charles Dickens said that the time of the French Revolution was the best of times and the worst of times. I say, had Dickens been alive in the early 20th century, he may well have reserved that phrase for the events of World War I and the subsequent peace settlement following the armistice in November 11, 1919 in Paris. Upon close examination, these world-shattering events seem to rise to the level of biblical prophetic fulfillment, kind of a temptation. The Olivet Discourse, days before his death, Jesus warns that nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, Luke 21:10. It is tempting to see this verse as fulfilled in World War I or World War II, and I know at least one well-known commentator does that. I'm not convinced, but it's possible. I have to explain a little more for me. However, tempting that is, it does give us a taste of things to come when we see the earth in an ever-sharpening contest with evil, and do we see that today? The prophesied seventh week of Daniel, also known as the tribulation, seems nearly upon us, or upon them, and seems now almost upon us, but we must say, but not yet. 32 countries chose a winning side, duke it out, largely in the trenches of France. A war that lasts 4.5 years cost all sides, and I don't know how many, depending on how you figure, 8 million, I've read up to 50 million with casualties. Further, this war had no objective, was started over the assassination of the Archduke of Austria, which was not a tragedy for anyone. No one missed him when he went, but festered as a minor border dispute that could have been settled by a local tribal war. Yet because of the spaghetti works alliances, Germany and Russia were respectively drawn into the Australian-Serbian dispute in 1914, summer of. Remember that while the German Kaiser was on vacation, Austria initiated a border challenge based on Germany's I've got your back promises. When arriving home, the Kaiser is mortified that Austria had actually taken action without checking with him first, but alliances matter. So the Tsarist Russia backs Serbia and is committed to her defense if it attacked. But still, 3 months away, it's really hard to express your I got your back expression. Anyway, the war started. The German ambassador approached. The war was impending. The German ambassador approaches the Russian Tsar Nicholas II, begging not to support Serbia in this minor border dispute. Nicholas, in a moment of strength, in spite of his weakness, refuses, and Russia declares war on Germany. Well, the war that no one wanted, provided nothing of value to anyone, was underway, spreading like gangrene. The worst of times, Germany becomes the scapegoat in the conflict. Germany, a nascent nation made up of many smaller German-speaking provincial groups, Bavaria is one, Saxony is another one, these groups that we know them by still those areas' names. These provincial groups was unified as the Second Reich in 1871 by Bismarck. As a new nation, it looked it was looked upon with suspicion in the days of imperialism. Remember, imperialism is the aggressor nations go take more property. America's always been accused of imperialism. I said, what does that word mean? Because I don't see it. But anyway, you don't hear it too much anymore. Major powers did have colonial farm clubs to harvest wealth and provide military manpower for their imperialistic wars. True. So what does Germany want with the war? Assumed. More territory. Everybody else has got territories around the world. Germany's none. It's a new nation yet. You ever been to the German islands in the Caribbean? Have you been to the British islands in the Caribbean? Or if you could go there. How about the French? You see, you've got all these, but no Germans. So they really didn't have any farm clubs. At the time of the Versailles Conference, there could not have assembled any more positive-outlooking world leaders than gathered at Paris 2 months after the armistice. At least this was so for President Woodrow Wilson of the United States. Now, it would be naive to say that all the leaders assembled shared Wilson's optimism, but we can say that his 14-point plan for peace, world peace, eternal peace, was optimistic. But what was the alternative? Now, this peace plan had really been conjured up in his mind long before this, probably a year before, around the time when America entered the war. Europeans generally welcomed Wilson's points, but his main allied colleagues, Clemenceau, George from England, Orlando from Italy, were skeptical of the applicability of Wilsonian idealism. Wilsonian idealism was rooted in his theology. Yes, these are the days when you can still talk about theology and be a politician. Now, I'm not sure he had held this on his sleeve, but this was his theology. Wilsonian idealism was rooted in his theology. From this day, from the days when theology mattered, even to world-class leaders, theological issues were completely incompatible with the Christian West. And you could talk about it. As I said last week, the big questions and the answers for them always start in the metaphysical realm, or we call it the spiritual realm. So Wilson, a Christian, I don't know what kind, beginning in the metaphysical, believes that God is acting in history in his nation's future. His convictions were not based on the revelation of the Bible, but lie in the ideal that Christianity will prosper, advance by democracy, form a world that is perfected to the necessary state required for the return of Christ. We call it the Second Advent. Wilson was a postmillennialist, as were most mainline denominational Protestant churches. The Bible Conference movement changed that for the independents or the new churches that were being formed. A lot of those were the Baptist churches. They were premillennial, dispensational premillennial. Of course, what you believe will shape your activity, as it did Wilson's. Who does not want a legacy? He wanted to see the world at peace and had his reasons to believe that God was going to make it happen through his actions as the President of the United States. However, United States Congress did not share that enthusiasm for Wilson's ideals for world peace. The tool, the League of Nations, which is to say talk, not shoot diplomacy, was rejected by his own Congress to his embarrassment and great disappointment, which may have sent him to an early grave at age 67. Again, at the time of the Versailles Conference, there could not have been assembled any more positive outlooking world leaders than gathered in Paris. Hubris, probably. The opportunity to get the world order right once and for all was inescapable. However, the task before these men was gargantuous. The double-edged sword was to take the opportunity to reorder the world to perfection or to fail to perfect the nations, making it even worse. For 6 months in 1919, Paris was the capital of the world. The Peace Conference was the world's most important business. The peacemakers, in its most powerful people, met day after day, argued, debated, quarreled, made up again. They created new countries and new organizations. They dined together, went to theater together. Between January and June, Paris was at once the world's government, its court of appeal, and its parliament, the focus of its fears and hopes, and the final judge of all earthly matters. Sounds like the roar returned. Officially, the peace conference lasted into 1920, but the first 6 months are the ones that count before everybody went home, left it to the bureaucrats. When the key decisions were taken and the crucial chains of events were set in motion. And the world has never seen anything quite like it, and likely never will unless we count the time when the Lord comes, and that'll be quite different. The Paris Peace Conference is usually remembered for producing the German Treaty signed at Versailles in June 1919. But it was always about much more than that, and that's why we're interested in this. The other enemies, Bulgaria, Austria, Hungary, now separate countries, and the Ottoman Empire, had to have their treaties. You know, we have an armistice, which is just a ceasefire. Now you have to make an agreement with these nations, these belligerent nations, with the world that wants to be at peace. So each one of these countries needed to have a separate peace agreement, and they were negotiated at the Versailles Conference. New borders had to be drawn in the center of Europe and across the Middle East. Most important of all, the international order had to be recreated on a new and different basis. Was the time now ripe for an international labor organization, a League of Nations for agreements on international telegraph cables or international aviation? Can you imagine back in those days they hadn't figured that out yet? Barely just had the railroad. After such a great catastrophe, World War I, the expectations were enormous. I guess it's kind of like you've been sick and you go throw up really good hard and you feel better. And you think that must be how they thought. We got rid of our disease, now we're going to be better. Well, Wilson's 14 points to end all wars were passed or shared to the Congress, the United States, and become a recipe for the Versailles Conference. So high expectations, high hopes for self-interest and self-determination embedded in Wilson's 14 articles was the idea that people will have an opportunity to shape the nation in which they would live. And it goes like this: a free, open-minded, and absolutely impartial adjustment of all colonial claims based upon a strict observance of the principle that in determining all such questions of sovereignty, the interest of the population concerns must have equal weight with the equitable claims of the government whose title is to be determined. Did you follow that? Well, we will digest it in a minute. It's an open-minded, absolutely impartial adjustment. Are we already off the limits from humanity? All colonial claims based on strict observance of the principle that in determining all such questions of sovereignty, the interest of the populations concerned must have equal vote. You know, sort of I get the idea that the politicians look you in the eye and says, I'll do what you want me to do. Except you look at 1,000 people. So we have these unrealistic expectations. On the right, on the left, we have the Kaiser looking up the stairs. And at the top is peace. And he can't even make the first step. And on the other side, we have a cartoon that shows Wilson being yelled at by every nation in the world by why they're not getting what they want. Unrealistic expectations. Got to fit into this formula, and there has to be some responsibility taken somewhere for this. If you ran into a man on the street who is selling you a perpetual motion machine or engine that will run forever, never need fuel, and never needs repair, and you can be on the ground floor owning 50% of the patent rights, for a limited time, this opportunity can be had for a mere $500. Would you invest? Would you invest for $250? Maybe you don't know anything about what I just read. This is an impossibility. There's no such thing as a perpetual motion machine, even though some people think somebody's going to invent one someday. The laws of God do not allow it. So if you ran into a man on the street who is selling you a perpetual motion engine that will run forever, need no fuel, and never needs repair, and that you could be on the ground floor owning 50% of this company for a limited time, if you hurry up and make a decision before you leave me, you know, this lasts only till, you know, would you go for it for a mere $500? Would you invest? Now say, if you did invest, later found that it was a fraud, how many of your friends would have any sympathy for your situation? How stupid can you be? And we think that, you know what the guy did? Guy come along, he'd probably buy this kind of thing. And I'm saying, don't be so stupid. All what I'm saying here is there's some responsibility when you make a decision or accept some conditions. So we have this, a buyer beware, you should lick the gift horse in the mouth. All these things are there. So we have these promises made by Wilson on this number 5 point, for example, and anybody looks at that with any kind of brain in his mind, says it's impossible for anybody to perform under these conditions. But all we hear is, "No, we didn't get our, we didn't get what you promised. Didn't get what you promised." Well, let's say you went to this thing expecting something that was impossible. So I think there's some responsibility there. All right, unrealistic. What is not realistic ought not to be expected. All right, we have read Wilson's fifth point: a free, open, and absolutely impartial adjustment of all colonial games. Get this: all colonial. How many to 10 people? You know how many. Strict observance of the principle that determining all such questions of sovereignty, the interest of the population concerned must have equal weight. How do you do that? But see, this why he was, and I think he wrote this about 2 o'clock in the morning, Wilson, and never read it again. But he was optimistic. So we bring up this point because later Arab claims attempting to invalidate the action of the peace conference, claiming that the local population in the Levant were not consulted in the setting of the borders. They could point to number 5 and say, see, didn't ask us, nor did they vote on the government of their choice. However, one of the realities of the peace conference action is that they did not consult with any of the peoples to determine their governance. Not just the people in Levant. They never asked anybody. Yeah, it's the Turks. I'm just telling you the story. They divided up Turkey, like made it look like a Holstein cow of different colors than just black and white. So this whole idea that they were denied some rights here is empty. Yet, although the fifth, this is going to be confirming this. This is from McMillan's book. Yet, although the fifth of Wilson's 14 points had talked about taking the interest of the indigenous population to account, no one had actually bothered to consult the Africans or the Pacific Islanders. We could say, or we could add, nor did they consult the Middle East people for that matter. Since it was not done anywhere, that by itself does not invalidate what was done by their representatives. The Arab complains today that they were not consulted as representing the Arabs' interest. But there were Arabs who did make claims of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman delegates were led by Hussein Raf, a young naval hero, a new minister of the Navy in October 28, 1919, during the conference. As did Faisal, we know him, friend of Lawrence of Arabia, as well as did Lawrence. We know some of those guys' stories. True, but there was no vote taken in any other country. But the people were given hearing. But the people were given a hearing through their leaders. The populace, the citizens must live with the results. This is the way it has always been, is it not? When a country gets conquered by another power and peace is settled, do the people in the country have a decision to make? No, they're stuck where they are. You know, we remember in the 30 Years' War in 1600s, you went to bed Catholic and woke up Protestant because the night the borders changed. Yeah, that's the way it was. If you're born in a family that's rich, that's the way it is. If you're born in a family that's poor, that's the way it is. There's certain things that you just don't change. And so it is when a nation gets conquered, the indigenous people got to live with the new leaders. So we do appeal to the rules of war here, as we've talked about earlier. The aggressor nation was the Ottoman Empire, while a small group of rebels peeled off to join the British, which is true, Faisal. They were hardly a significant force to have independent claims at the Paris Conference. They didn't show up as a group. They weren't big enough to make a difference. They were grouped with the other indigenous people and given their lot. That's how these guys did it. So we have this representative, Hussein Raf, I mentioned to him. Well, were the Arab interests ignored or were they just mistreated? When Raf arrived home, listen to what he says. Now, he's talking in behalf of the Arab agreement with the people at Versailles. When Raf entered home, he told a reporter, "I assure you." Now, they're worried about that England and these other countries would come into Turkey and just decimate Constantinople and so forth. So this guy comes and assures them that not one single enemy soldier will disembark at Istanbul. The British had treated them extraordinarily well. The armistice we have concluded is beyond our hopes. even though they had accepted all the clauses put forward by the British, Ralph trusted Cal Trope, British admiral, who promised that the armistice terms would not be used unfairly. The British were generally only interested in free passage, he thought, the straits, make sure that the Bosphorus stayed open, get into the Black Sea. Why would the British want to occupy Constantinople or anywhere else? So they didn't see British as being expansionistic here. They were happy with what they came up with. Ralph told himself that after all, the British had already taken the Arab territories. And notice, had already taken the Arab territories, Allenby. I could think of no other area that they would want from the point of view of their national interests, and so might try to seize it. When these two men put their signatures on the armistice in October 30, they cheerfully toasted each other in champagne. Does it sound like this is duress? Now, these are representatives. He's a representative of their people at Versailles. Now, in the back of the mind, if the men would say that were making these decisions, would say to themselves, well, the peace terms were imperfect. There would be plenty of time later for the League to correct them. Many new borders had to be drawn. If they were not quite right, the League would sort them out. They would have the authority. Germany's colonies were going to be taken away that they had taken, you know, Poland, the areas that Russia had, goes back to Germany. Now Germany's going to give them up, going to give them to Poland again, where the Jews live, remember, the Pale. The League would make sure that they were run properly, these Germans' colonies, where they were. The Ottoman Empire was defunct. The League would act as liquidator and trustee for the people who were not yet ready to rule themselves. Eternal optimism springs eternal. And for the future generation, the League would oversee general prosperity and peace, encouraging the weak, chiding the wicked, and where necessary, punishing the recalcitrant. Does that make sense to you? Does that sound kind of like a messianic complex? It was a pledge that humanity was making to itself, a covenant. The millennium is coming soon. Well, Harold Nicholson, a British diplomat involved in the conference, spoke for many of his generation when he said, "We were journeying to Paris not merely to liquidate the war, but to found a new order in Europe. We were preparing not peace only, but eternal peace. There was about us the halo of some divine mission. We must be alert, CERN. We are bent on doing great, permanent, and noble things." Optimism. With this optimism, the Paris Peace Conference launched itself into a new age, a new way of doing things. The hope of postmillennialism was that in each and every way, we were getting better every day. You heard that one. The hope that the last war was the last war, to end the wars. Surely, the horrible costs and lives and fortunes cannot, will not, ever be repeated. 20 years later, it started again. The Jews will echo this refrain again after the Holocaust, World War II, and we still hear it today. You hear it over there. It will not happen again. It will not happen again. It will not happen again. We will die here, but it will not happen again. So we have the Paris Peace Conference, just one of the gorgeous palaces in this wonderful place. Make sure to stop by there some weekend if you have a chance. The peace to end all peace. Okay, just kind of the reminder of you, to you. The green is the West that won the war, so to speak. And the yellow, the ochre, is the Allied or Axis part. It's, I guess there was a second war called the Axis. I don't know what they call them, World War I, the German part. And the gray, not very many gray, see South America on the western coast, Mexico, Saudi Arabia, Iran are out of it, as Iceland and Greenland. I mean, I'm sure they were significant. So we have mostly everybody against just a few here. Now, the British held all these territories. Then we said the sun never set on the British Empire. You can see why. And then we have what was held by the French. They had quite a bit. We have those in Laos and some of those in Madagascar off the coast of Africa, in central West Africa. And then we have the little patch there, which is actually going to be given to them in the French mandate in the Upper Levant. And then we have the territories held by the United States. You see, they really don't hold much. I guess the last one that actually took any land and kept it would be Teddy Roosevelt in the little war, they called it a little nifty little war, where it took the Philippines. But, you know, we don't, the United States has really never been an imperialistic power, although it's been been accused of all the time. That gives a little picture of the world powers, where they had land. We have the law hall where they met. 32 countries, 32 countries, 27 nations assigned to 52 commissions. So there were a lot of bureaucratic meetings going on. And like I said, about the middle of 1919, the big boys went home and let the cleanup operations to the rest. And they consulted back and forth. They had wire telegraphs over. They could talk back and forth. So it wasn't done like without their without their knowledge. But the big ones were the one in Germany. That was done by then. On January 12th, the day after the arrival in Paris, George Clemenceau, Wilson, and Orlando, Italy, at the French Foreign Ministry on Croix d'Auxerre for the first of well over 100 meetings. Each man brought his foreign secretary and a bevy of advisors. The following day, the defense to British wishes. Two Japanese representatives joined the group, and that became the Council of Ten. I don't count ten there, but I guess you've got to count some of their assistants to make ten. At the end of March, the peace conference reached its crucial struggles. The Supreme Council was to shed its foreign ministers and the Japanese to become the Council of Four. The Japanese really don't have much interest in the Western world, at least they didn't then, until World War II came around. So we have these four guys, sometimes there's three. Italy's not all that influential here. So we have the fate of the many people rested in the decision-making powers of these four world leaders. Now, it really is quite amazing. You think about what was decided by these men. We have one from England, one from Italy, we have one from France, and one from the United States. And what they decided became international law because it was ratified by a bigger group. But these are the ones that came up with it. And you can see that you got, you know, 30, 40 people arguing. It's very cumbersome. So you had to reduce it down to a point where you could look somebody in the eye and argue with them and get an advantage. So that's what they did. They finally got it down to four who really made the major decisions for everybody. One by one, the nations withstanding appeared before these committees to argue their cases. Some presented cases affecting changes, got their way, others did not. Germany was near the beginning, took the longest, and ended on May 7, 1919. While Wilson's 14 laws or rules did not have any punitive measures for belligerent nations in them, it didn't need any, because personal memory filled in the space with harsh treatments for the Germans. Now, I have learned a little bit through this study, and I maybe changed my mind even a little bit about this whole thing. For me now, it is hard to see such a one-sided view of the war as was the case that had been presented in the public. Here again, hubris, that proud spirit, ruled the day, and strident measures were imposed on the present generation of Germans as well as on many more generations to come. And I was going to look up, you know, what the reparations were for Germany. They were so huge, I mean, it wouldn't matter. So I just brought you one. They were saddled with paying the war debt of other nations. Even just the civil damage alone was $133 billion, and just the beginning of it. And you looked at that, and of course they protested, and it made no difference because they were so, so angry with Germany. I mean, the world was so, so incensed with Germany. And I go back and explain to me, why is it now we're so angry with Germany? Why aren't you mad at Russia? Well, anyway, leaving that aside, we're interested in the Zionist part, aren't we? When the Zionist mission appeared before the Supreme Court on February 27th, see, quite early in the year, Chaim Weizmann, was not the only speaker. No American Zionist spoke, partly because the chief spokesman had not arrived from London, but several Europeans did. The Polish writer Nahum Sokolow reminded his listeners of the dreadful plight of the Jewish of Eastern Europe. Remember, in Russia, and then they became Prussia first, then became Russian. Then actually, that's far as we need to go, because there's going to be another shift in World War II. So he says, the hour of deliverance of this unhappy people has struck. Wiseman, who stood watching him, later recalled, I could see Sokolow's face, and without being sentimental, it was as if 2,000 years of Jewish suffering rested on his shoulders. Well, no decision was made on Palestine that day or for the months to come. Wouldn't you just expect that? And it barely came up at subsequent meetings at the peace conference. Probably the biggest issue, as it is, often happens in Paris, an issue that was to cause increasing trouble over the years, was scarcely considered at all. On the other hand, the Palestinians were very bitter over the Balfour Declaration, reported the American intelligence officer in 1917. Well, there are other people unhappy too, I suppose. It also reflected this condition in the Middle East. Sort of out of the way, no man, I called it open range. It's not important. So it also reflected the tendency on the part of both of the world statements that and Zionist leaders to see Palestine as somehow empty. There's nothing there, nothing to fight over. What's the point? If the Zionists do not go there, says Sykes, remember Sykes and Pico, those two guys, Sykes was a British. Sykes firmly said, someone will. Nature abhors a vacuum. He knows the science. A British Zionist is supposed to have coined the phrase, the land without people, or for the people without land. Well, another problem for the dividers was the spoils of the war was the way the new borders were to be drawn. There was supposed to be pure altruism running in the veins of the negotiators. They were there to make sure that now was not the time to be land-grabbing when the borders were in a state of flux. So what's to be done with the land that is freed from the dissolved countries or of land conquest or land conquest by the Allies? If it was annexed, that country would be charged with land-grabbing. So enter John Smuts. The land needed some assignment made to, who knows, and somehow do this without accusing the victors of the accusing the victors in the armistice agreement. The British statesman John Smuts came up with the idea of mandates or mandated territories, where parent nations are given the responsibility of oversight of fledging nations. The territories were assigned letters A, B, and C. That's elementary, Watson. A, B, and C. Each representing a level of self-governance or ability of self-governance. A represent immediate self-governance. B, longer wait. C, undeveloped people that need more oversight to bring them to national independence. So you'd have Levant is actually going to be A, and you have in some of the darkest of Africa, where they're still running as tribes, be C, take a little longer. And the Ottoman Empire, as I just got through saying, got the A. Now, lest we think that there were only two mandates, like French and British, look at the mandates that exist here. Hey, I can even draw, I found out. So look at all these mandates. It wasn't just those two. Now, we're interested in these mandates here, one and two. Can you see what I'm doing? I don't want to look. All right, so here's these mandates. So in other words, I want you to know there weren't just two mandates. There are many mandates. The mandate system was established by Article 22 in the Covenant of League of Nations, entered into 28 June 1919. The very word mandate had a benevolent and pleasing sound. And that's very important. Initially, it also caused considerable confusion when it was produced at the peace conference because the press called it land grabbing just to cover for that, which it wasn't, but at least the press was doing its job that day. This plan, defined as the mandate system, was adopted by the Council of Ten, remember, started that before, the heads of the governments, so forth, on January 30, 1919. So really quite early. On May 7, now about the middle of the year, almost, after the Germans had received their terms, you know, it's like they gave it to them. Here's our answer, Germany. And they got to say, you got to be kidding. I mean, I don't know what they said. Maybe they said words I couldn't use here. But it really threw them for a loop because they thought they would come off with reparations, but not what they got. So on May 7, after the Germans had received their terms, Clemenceau, Lloyd George, Wilson, and Orlando met in the room at Versailles and agreed on the final distribution of the mandates over the former German colonies. And get this, they were still haggling over the wreckage of the Ottoman Empire in the Middle East. And I think they went home here after June. There was no determination made on the Ottoman land directly in the Versailles Conference. However, with the disbanding of the conference in January 20, all the unfinished business was continued to the League of Nations. It was brand new, January of 20. The question of the Levant migrated to the League of Nations upon adjournment at Versailles. The Big Ten had reduced to the Big Four, were given the duty to determine the plan for the Ottoman Empire. See, the harder the question gets, the fewer people are involved in making the answer, which is probably what it's going to have to be. But it opens up criticism, I suppose. So now we go to the San Remo, Italy Conference, April 20. And you have a modern picture of it if you would like to go to Italy and spend an evening there, a night there. I'm sure you can because it is a bed and breakfast now, or whatever you call them. So the Remo Italy Conference, and we have the men standing in front there, obviously more than four because they brought all their secretaries and all their whatever. So the conference, attended by Great Britain, France, Italy, Japan really didn't care, with the United States. Remember, the United States was not part of the League of Nations, so they couldn't be part of this. I think that's kind of fortuitous that, you know, God kept them out of this, because the United States at this point would probably push for it, because later on they will vote for it. But anyway, the United States has nothing to say about this. So they're a neutral observer, and it was held at San Remo, Italy. The conference was a continuation. Remember, it's a continuation of previous meeting between the Allied power that had been held in London, February 1920, which is a month after the Versailles quit. So they immediately got to work on it. And at this conference, I looked, try to find any information on it, and maybe it's out there. I couldn't find it. More details about that conference in London. But it was at that conference, among many things, to put the British under the Palestine under the British mandate rule. They had that kind of authority. Although, with the Balfour letter, you'd think that would be the natural choice. So at San Remo, the Allies confirmed the pledge contained in the Balfour Declaration concerning the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine. The British delegation at San Remo was headed by Prime Minister Lord George Curzon, which is now a successor of Balfour, who was also there as a consultant. Now, the Treaty of Sèvres, or however you say it, was the one that is about Turkey when they went back to war because they didn't like the Holstein-Kiel division. So they had to go back and redo that. And it's probably the only place that I know of there was war because of it, and they redid it for it. And that was the Ottoman breakup wasn't completely clean because there were Turkish people left that end up getting a land, which is what we call Turkey today. That's really what they got. And Atatürk was the first prime minister. So now we move to the League of Nations. We are going to be done soon, so you get your questions ready, which I won't be able to answer. Now we go to the League of Nations, Geneva. This is the world headquarters of the new Messianic Kingdom. The Ottoman Empire is no more. But there will be a Turkey, but not an Ottoman Empire. The League of Nations on July 24, 1922, embodied in the British mandate the language of the Balfour Declaration that gave Great Britain temporary administrative control over Palestine. The language has never changed. And we've had this little chart up before. You go through each one of these. Some of these don't affect it, like this one here's on Austria. This one's about Bulgaria. This one has to do with Hungary. And here we come to the San Remo Conference. So we go from Versailles down to San Remo. So then we come back there down here to the ratification act eventually by the Treaty of Lausanne, which is the League of Nations, where they accept everything that's been done till now. And some of the things that were done till now were illegal. I will point that out later, but I don't want to mess you up because at this point it's all been settled and they accept even the mistakes that were made, which makes some questions for us later. So I'll pray and I'll let you go. Lord, thank you for the evening together, for again the discovery of this Middle East history. Lord, it is exciting. It is complex. It is amazingly complex to say the least, to see through this maze you perfect exactly what you want on May 14, 1948, A Nation Born in a Day. Unbelievable at this point of view from the Versailles Conference and so forth. But Lord, we're confident in what the Word tells us, not only about the past, but also about the future. And Lord, we wait for your return. Thank you, Lord, for this local church that relishes in that truth. We find our hope in it as we find ourselves more and more in a world that is adverse to you and your ways. Help us, Lord, to be patient with that. Use it as a springboard to share the gospel. Thank you, Lord, for those that came tonight, and bless us as we go to our home. Keep us safe and everything we ask. In Jesus' name, amen.